Okay. Good morning. My name is Victoria DeSimone. I'm a program manager for the Diversity and National Security Project at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. I also have the honor of being a recipient of the Ricardo Salino Foundation Scholarship for the 2017 Aspen Security Forum. I'm honored to introduce our next session, Fight Tonight. The prospect of nuclear war on the Korean Peninsula has never been higher. The North Koreans have just launched an ICBM and will soon be able to mount a nuke on a missile able to hit the lower 48 states. The Trump administration has announced ominously that strategic patience has been a conspicuous failure, and that if the Chinese will not or cannot solve the North Korean problem, the United States will. Short of war, can Kim Jong-un be stopped? Moderating this session is Gordon Chang. Gordon G. Chang is the author of The Coming Collapse of China, The Nuclear Showdown North Korea Takes on the World. His writings have appeared in The New York Times, The Wall Street Journal, Barron's, The Weekly Standard, Commentary, and The National Interest, among other publications. Chang has frequently appeared on CNN, Fox News Channel, Fox Business Network, Bloomberg, CNBC, and MSNBC. He is a columnist at The Daily Beast and a contributor at Forbes.com. He is also a member of the Cypherbrief Network and has served two terms as trustee of Cornell University. Please join me in welcoming our panel.
Victoria, thank you, but don't go. Stay here, come back a moment. You know, as we just all heard, the Aspen Institute is developing the next generation of America's national security professionals, and I can't think of a higher priority for our nation. So, Victoria, to you and to your other Aspen Security Forum scholars, you know, thank you so much for taking up security studies at a very crucial moment in our nation's history.
Thank you, Gordon.
Thank you.
And while I'm in this grateful mood, I'd like to thank the older folks at Security Forum, Clark and his great team, for putting all this together. Fight Tonight. That's the title of this panel. It's also the motto of U.S. Forces Korea. 3 weeks ago in Seoul, I heard General Vincent Brooks, who's the commander of USFK, talk about this phrase. And he said that it's not just a mere expression. It's a state of existence. And I would add, it's also a reminder that in the next few hours, American forces could be involved in history's next great conflict. Several moments this year, the possibility of war looked high. You know, this year we've seen tensions high on the Korean Peninsula. They've subsided, and then they flared back up again. Now, in previous years, we've also witnessed this cycle of high tensions followed by pauses. And so we need to ask ourselves one question. Is what is occurring this year, is it normal, or is it structurally different? I'd like to start with you, Chris Hill. You were U.S. ambassador to South Korea. You drove Korea policy in the Bush administration, assistant secretary of state for East Asia, led the delegation in the six-party talks. And also, you've been a civilian, and you've seen all of these cycles. So the question is that I pose, let me put it maybe in a different way. Is what we're seeing this year dangerous, more dangerous, or is it just more of the same?
I would put it in the more dangerous category, which is not to say that what we all dealt with 5-10 years ago was not dangerous, but this is more dangerous. First of all, we have leadership in North Korea that is, to put it gently, sort of not up to the task. Kim Jong-un has shown no interest in negotiation. He doesn't really care what we think. He doesn't care what China thinks. He frankly doesn't care what anyone thinks. So we have a rather difficult customer to deal with. He has shown no interest in negotiation, but also no interest in denuclearization. To the extent he's wanted to meet with us, it's been in the context of sort of one nuclear power with another. So I think there's a lot to be concerned about there. Secondly, I think it's important, and I have a very strong view on this, I think it's important to understand that the North Koreans are not some plucky little country that wants a couple of nuclear weapons to scare away, you know, bigger predators. You know, if that were the case, you might be able to find a way forward. But I think their ambitions with nuclear weapons are quite large. And it essentially has to do with a view, I mean, I think an unrealistic view. And to have the view, you kind of have to be a North Korean to understand it. But I think what they really want to do is drive a wedge between the Republic of Korea and the United States and ultimately decouple the United States from the Republic of Korea and from the Korean Peninsula. I think there's a view in North Korea that somehow they could somehow unite the Korean Peninsula if they could only get that great power off the peninsula. So I think the development, especially of ICBMs, their capability, their survival capability with new rockets, is really aimed at kind of threatening the United States. So if the United States were to get involved, as it must, in the sort of equivalent of Article 5, as we all know from NATO, were we to be involved, the North Koreans would say, not so fast, because we'll hit you. And, of course, our answer would be, you hit us with a nuclear weapon, we'll obliterate you. And I think the North Koreans kind of say, game on. So the question would be, would the South Korean people believe that an American president, I'm going to leave aside the question of the current president, because I think this is not about who the American president is, but would an American president be prepared to expose American civilians to a nuclear attack in order to exercise our responsibilities? So I think this is an extremely dangerous circumstance we're in, and I'm of the view, and I'll stop here, but I'm of the view that this is not a choice to engage in this issue. We absolutely must, through various means, deny North Korea the capability of having a deliverable nuclear weapon. They do not have it now, but they will have it if we continue to be patient.
Yeah, Chris, I think it's very important. You know, you mentioned internal dynamics in North Korea, and I hope that we get to this later on, because the regime does seem to be less stable than other ones. And so that it gives us a sort of a sense of pause that this is indeed something that we have not seen before. Ambassador An Ho-young, you see this from a different perspective, of course, because you're up close to North Korea. What did you think about what Ambassador Hill just said?
Well, as a matter of fact, Ambassador Hill and I, we go back a long, long time, back to 2004. And then what I can tell you on record with this, which is that more than 13 years now, there has been not a single moment when I said, I don't agree with Ambassador Hill.
Oh, okay.
So I totally agree with what we just heard from Ambassador Hill. But at the same time, well, Chris made several points, and then the last point he made was something called extended deterrence. Extended deterrence. That, in fact, is a core of commitment which the United States has made to Korea. And then the thing is, that extended deterrence, the United States extended not only to Korea, but to Japan and to some other countries in Western Europe. So the thing is, it is not just one issue between Korea and then the United States. It, in fact, is a global issue, it's a strategic issue, and the most essential issue. And we often think about the global leadership of the United States, and that extended deterrence responsibility and commitment of extended deterrence, that, in fact, is a core element of United States as a global leader. But at the same time, getting back to another point, which is that, well, I should be beginning by thanking you. I mean, when I say thanking you, you in each and every one of you, but at the same time, organize of this particular security conference here at the Aspen Institute, and then for a very good reason, in the sense that I arrived in Aspen at 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon. 1 o'clock yesterday afternoon. And I attended the conference up until 6 o'clock in the evening. What happened during those 5 hours? You were there, and then you were there with me. And then during those 5 hours, then we had an opportunity to listen to current DNI, former DNI, former CIA director, and chairman of House Armed Services Committee, chairman of Homeland Security Committee, ranking member of Intelligence Committee. Well, you also threw in commander of Special Operations Forces. I couldn't believe it. It was only 5 hours, and then I could listen to each and every one of them all in 5 hours. And then that, in fact, is the reason why I should be beginning by thanking you.
But you know what's best of all?
Uh-huh.
The guy on your right.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Chris Hill, you got Chris Hill to talk to.
Of course. But at the same time, there was one question, same question, which had been raised again and again and again with at least three of them. There is current DNI, former DNI, and then former director for CIA. If you can remember, then there was one question, and one question was this, which is, if there is one issue which keeps you awake in the evening, what would that be? You remember the question? So that question has been raised with each and every one of those important leaders of the United States. Do you remember what the answer was? The answer was terrorists. Terrorists indoctrinated in dangerous ideologies. That was the answer. I was just looking at Ulf Blitzer. Ulf Blitzer, he didn't seem to be happy with the answer, so he just carried. Well, what do you think about North Korea? And then if you remember, then that's what, I guess it was General Clapper. General Clapper, he said, well, of course, there is increasing threat, but at the same time, we should put it in perspective. That, in fact, is a danger, but at the same time, that is not, this is one word which I always find it too difficult to pronounce, which is existential threat.
Uh-huh.
He said, well, we are not there yet. So I agree with everything that has been said by Chris, but at the same time, one last point I should be making would be this, which is let us just put these issues in perspective.
Well, Ambassador Ahn, you talked about extended deterrence, which means you're talking about the U.S.-South Korea treaty. And we have been treaty partners for 63 years now. But as Chris mentioned, North Korea is trying to break the alliance apart. And one of the things that China has been trying to do is this concept of a freeze. Now, your new president, Moon Jae-in, has been on the record as saying that he'd like to see a freeze of North Korea's missile and nuke programs. And there are rumors only, unconfirmed, that President Moon would like China's proposal of a double freeze, which means not only North Korea freezing its weapons programs, but also South Korea and the U.S., the alliance, freezing exercises on the peninsula. Your comments.
Well, you just said it. There's a rumor. And then my very simple answer, very short answer, is it's a rumor. And then, as a matter of fact, President Moon, he never supported such idea. Why? For a very good reason. Because let us just look at what we are doing in response to North Korean threat. There are three important elements in our overall package. One, sanction. Two, engagement. Three, deterrence. They are three important elements in our package. And as a matter of fact, that package will not stand with any one of them without in the package. So let us just think about deterrence. Deterrence wouldn't be possible unless North Koreans are convinced that United States will continue to be in South Korea, and then there will be continued strengthening of this military relationship between Korea and then the United States. And how do we ensure that? We cannot ensure that without military training. So as a matter of fact, there is no way that President Moon could be agreeing to that idea.
Okay.
So my simple answer, again, is it's a rumor. He never said that.
Okay. Let's go to the guy on the left. you got
so
the joke.
To speak.
Joe Cinceroni, who is president of Plowshares and one of the most acclaimed nuclear experts in the United States.
I got to come here more often.
Well, they're really making you work. I mean, probably you're going to be on the panel after this one as well. But, you know, while we got you here, double freeze, good idea, bad idea?
It's the only idea.
Ah.
It's the only idea. You know, Ambassador Young just articulated the stance of President Moon. And, by the way, Ambassador Young and I go way back. We were classmates at Georgetown in the MSFS program. So it's proof that if you hang around Washington long enough, your friends become famous.
Oh, you know, but while we're playing this game of who knows Ambassador Ahn better, let me say that he and I share a birthday.
So the balance is you have to have a credible military threat or deterrence, but you also have to have engagement. You also have to have engagement here. You heard yesterday Director Clapper said that he doesn't consider North Korea an existential threat, whereas Russia is was very certainly an existential threat. The President of the United States says it's important to have dialogue with Russia. and I agree, probably our greatest geopolitical threat. We have to have dialogue with them. Why aren't we having dialogue with North Korea? You have to have that. It is the only thing that has stopped the North Korean program. Sanctions have not stopped it. Threats of military force have not stopped it. Ignoring the problem has not stopped it. Let's get China to take care of it has not stopped it. Historically, the only thing that stopped it is when we've been negotiating with the North Koreans. We had an 8-year freeze on their plutonium program, the fuel they use for their bombs. We had an 8-year freeze on their missile program. It's when we stopped engaging with them that everything went into high gear. 2006, in the Bush administration, they go nuclear. So the Bush administration policy failed. They tried some negotiations near the end, didn't work. And then the Obama administration's strategic patience was, I don't know how you gentlemen feel, that was a dismal failure. We have a more capable military program now in North Korea than anything we've seen in our lifetime. This is not your grandfather's nuclear program. This is a very capable, threatening, growing program that will allow the North Koreans to put a long-range missile with a thermonuclear warhead on Washington, New York, Seattle, or Los Angeles, probably by the end of President Trump's term. We've got to change strategy. We've got to engage. And what is the engagement? Not give up the nuclear weapons. I agree. They are not in the position to give them up, at least not now. But they have indicated they're willing to discuss a freeze. What they want is a freeze on U.S.-South Korean military exercises. This is very problematic for us. This is a core part of our deterrence. However, those exercises have grown tremendously over the last few years. It's one of the few things we've been able to do with North Korea, grow the exercise, grow the military posture here. You have room to shrink these, to freeze the most irritating, disturbing, threatening parts of them, the decapitation strikes that South Korea and the U.S. practice. There were things that can be done here that at least that could be talked about. It's urgent that we begin talks with North Korea about talks to see if there's something here. Without that, I don't see any solution to this problem. It's just going to grow worse.
Joe, you've raised a number of very important points, but before we get off the double freeze, Chris, what do you think about a double freeze?
I have a big problem with the double freeze. First of all, with great respect to Joe, with whom I've shared many panels, if not a birthday, I served in Korea in the mid-1980s, and every spring we had something called Team Spirit. And Team Spirit involved flying in tens of thousands of American troops, at times actually dropping them out of airplanes from places like Fort Hood. So, you know, they're in the airplane for God knows how many hours, and they come out in parachutes and ready to fight. I mean, just amazing. All of that has been scaled down dramatically in recent years. And I acknowledge what Joe said, that there's been some uptick in the level of exercises in the last few years in response to the North Korean threat. But I would emphasize that a lot of these, all of these exercises are premised on a North Korean attack against the Republic of Korea, always. So I understand, the concept that if you have exercises that are premised on, you know, you're invading North Korea, this should be upsetting to the North Koreans. But frankly, they are all based on defense. And by the way, they've invited observers to these things. So I think we have to understand the freeze on exercises would be part and parcel of a North Korean desire to weaken the alliance. Because when you have a military alliance that does not have the troops of the two members of the alliance working together, practicing together, understanding the same terrain, you have what begins to look like a paper alliance. Now, again, I was in the Foreign Service. I served in a lot of different places. One place I served was in Poland. And you don't need to know a lot of Polish history to understand that in 1939, Poland had a military alliance with Britain and France. And they never exercised together. The Brits and the French never sent troops to Poland. But it was on paper. They had this exercise. So Germans attacked Poland on September 1st. Britain and France dutifully declared war on Germany, and that was the end of it. And Poland was gone within weeks. In short, I think if we allow this kind of freeze, we would be going in the direction of a paper alliance and one that would not have the deterrent capability that we absolutely need. Because the North Koreans understand if they take a step into the Republic of Korea, they're messing with us. And I think that point has to be made every spring in the context of these exercises. And no, I would not freeze that.
Joe, you know, Ambassador Ahn talked about deterrence and the strength of the alliance. And it would seem to me, just I'll throw out an argument for you, that it would be difficult to have conversations with Pyongyang, if that's possible. But it would be difficult to have conversations with Pyongyang if the alliance weren't strong in the first place. Your response?
The alliance is strong. We have, obviously, we've had an alliance since 53, 54. We've been since the last Korean War. So this is a powerful, strong, I would say unbreakable alliance, and of course this added to by our alliance with Japan. Let me push back on this just for a second. Don't you think there are some elements of these exercises that could be curtailed? In particular, the decapitation exercises that we practice. Now, we say they're defensive, that in the case of a North Korean attack, we would then immediately launch these set of capabilities aimed at the North Korean leadership, and that's a deterrent. But when you couple that with CIA Director Pompeo's statement the other day that he wants to separate Kim Jong-un from his nuclear capability, I mean, how do you think the North Koreans see this? Shouldn't they be seeing this as a direct threat to their dynasty? Isn't that why they're pursuing nuclear weapons, self-preservation? Don't you think there's something that could be done here, some bargain that could relieve their security anxieties in exchange for them relieving some of ours?
Well, as a matter of fact, there are a large number of young people here. But at the same time, I think from time to time, it helps to think about history. And then I think it will be helpful for us to remember and remind ourselves how this team spirit exercise came to be about between Korea and the United States. And Joe is absolutely right in the sense that Korea-U.S. alliance, it has been there since 1953. But this team spirit exercise, it didn't start up until 1976. What happened in 1976? What happened was, up until that time, there is a place called Panmunjom. That, in fact, is a truce village in the DMZ. There is 2 miles DMZ to the north of the DMZ and then 2 miles to the south. At that time, the truce area, it in fact used to be under the joint surveillance between south and then the north, or between UN forces and then the north. Literally, there were forces from the United Nations and forces from Korea surveilling the same area. What happened was there was observation post in the south and observation post in the north, and there was a big tree which was obstructing the line of oversight on that particular area. So what happened was there was a small detachment of U.S. forces which was sent in there under the leadership of Captain Bonifacio. And then that, in fact, small detachment of U.S. soldiers, what they were doing, they were just trimming down the tree. And what happened? North Korea sent in large number of troops, and then what did the North Korean forces do? They just took the axe. I mean, the axe was being used in order to trim the trees, and then they hacked Captain Bonifacio to death, and then several others. That's what happened in 1976. That led to this team spirit exercise. But at the same time, when it comes to why military exercise is important, even between very close allies between Korea and the United States, well, Chris has already said it, and then I cannot say it any better than Chris did, which is that he just shared with us about the experiences of Poland back in 1939. And then I don't think I have to repeat what Chris said in emphasizing the importance of military exercise. With respect to Joe's point, well, to a certain degree, I agree with you in the sense that, well, rhetoric, it shouldn't get too high. Rhetoric, it shouldn't get too heated. And then at the same time, when it comes to the contents of exercise between Korea and the United States, important concept is coordination and consultation between Korea and the United States. So things are possible in accordance with coordination and consultation, but at the same time, I think military exercise is quintessentially important. But at the same time, I agree with one of the points you raised. Let us not raise the level of rhetoric too high. I, te- I, I definitely agree with you.
Gordon, can I just, for example, I think, Ambassador Ahn, that's a very important point. We need to coordinate and consult. For example, the new Republic of Korea president, President Moon Jae-in, announced a desire to have more talks with the North Koreans, so-called cross-border talks, mm-hmm. peninsula talks. I think it's very important for Americans to understand the complexity of the relationship between the ROK and North Korea. And I think it's important for Americans to understand that if they want to have talks based on family unification or various other things, it's very perilous territory for the United States to be telling its ally, oh, you can't talk to those people. So I think it's important that we have consultations on this sort of thing. But the Republic of Korea has an absolute sovereign right to engage in talks with its neighbors. The issue is, though, our issue is the issue of security and in particular, nuclear weapons. And that's where we have to be kind of all together here, you know, kapshi, kapshi da, et cetera. We have to be all together with the understanding that we don't want North Korea to try to use various elements of this complex history and complex peninsula to kind of divide us. That is the game they're playing. And so I think with respect to nuclear issues and anything stemming from the nuclear talks, we need to be like one.
Chris, you mentioned dividing the alliance, and there's one issue that is dividing the alliance right now, and we see over there, it says Lockheed Martin. They built the Terminal High Altitude Area Defense System under President Park Geun-hye, who's now no longer there. She agreed to the basing of the THAAD system, as it's called. Moon Jae-in, of course, has frozen that. And this looks like something that could divide Washington and Seoul. Joe, what do you think about THAAD?
I don't mean to be rude to Lockheed, because they've built a very capable system that has performed well in some very rudimentary tests. Not realistic tests, but rudimentary tests. I think they've hit 11 of their last 11 targets. But this is not an answer to the problem. THAAD cannot protect South Korea. It's not a system that's intended to provide a country defense. You have to understand this. If you think of Patriot as a system that defends an airport, THAAD has a slightly larger defended perimeter, but it's not a country defense. It's in its southern deployment, it can't really even protect Seoul. It doesn't have the range to protect Seoul, and it can be easily overwhelmed. So, for example, in the this most it's ever done in its tests is try to go up against two ballistic missile targets. We think North Korea has about 1,000 short and medium range ballistic missiles. At least a dozen or more of those could be armed with nuclear warheads. Plus, they have the last remaining formidable chemical weapons arsenal in the world, and might even be biological weapons, but those are hard to put on warheads. So missile defense is a nice symbol. It's a demonstration of commitment. It has some limited military capability to defend troops. But that's different from saying this is some kind of military answer to the threat, which it is not. So if you're going to deploy this piece on the chessboard, just be real clear that this is a pawn. It's not a knight.
Yeah, you know, if you go back to the early 1980s, the whole idea of the deployment of Pershing II in Europe was to deter the Soviets. And so there, again, it's symbolic. I agree it's symbolic in a way.
Well, Pershing II had real capability. These were nuclear missiles that were offensive missiles that could strike the Soviet Union.
But this
that
is,
was real.
This has become important. By the way, we are just about reached the halfway point. I'd like to bring in the audience early. But before I do, I want to get a question from the Twitterverse that came in early this morning. It's a guy named Tom Rufolf, and he says, suppose you have an honest broker supplied by the UN or somebody else. Would that be a way of going forward? Now, the last UN General Secretary was Ban Ki-moon in South Korea.
Right.
So what do you think, Ambassador Ahn, about an honest broker from the UN, such as maybe Ban Ki-moon?
Well, let us briefly go back to what Joe just said a couple of minutes ago. And then what he said was that, well, as a matter of fact, when it comes to double freeze, there is no other way than we can resolve this North Korean nuclear issue other than just sitting with North Korea.
Okay. Yeah.
And then that, in fact, was the point which Joe has been making. But at the same time, at that time, I didn't respond with this point. But the thing is, it is not South Korea. It is not United States. It is not anybody who are suggesting we are not going to discuss with you. In fact, we are making the proposal to North Korea. It is North Korea who is saying we are not interested in dialogue if the purpose is, of the dialogue is denuclearization. This may be something amazing for you, to a large number of you. Let me remind you, North Korea is the only country in the whole world which has written into constitutional law, we are a nuclear state. Can you think of any other country in the whole nation? There are more than 190 of them. Can you think of any other nation in the whole world who would be writing into its constitutional law, we are a nuclear state? If you are making this proposal of dialogue for the purpose of denuclearization, forget it. The only way we'll be sitting with you, United States, it will be only as a nuclear state to nuclear state. So it is not South Korea, it is not United States, which are not interested in having a dialogue. So Gordon, I'm making that response to you with respect to that idea of honest broker between each and every one of us. But as a matter of fact, honest broker, if he could be breaking this very realistic barrier we have, then let us think about it.
Okay. I've heard in the last couple of days very perceptive comments from the audience. And Clark, you know, you take the smartest people in the world, you put them in the same room, and who knew they'd come up with brilliant thoughts?
Wow.
So anyway, there's a woman over here. If we could, she told me before that she's never been able to ask a question at the forum, so here's her first.
Hi, Mika Ouyang. I'm the director of the National Security Program at Third Way. You've mentioned previously that this regime in North Korea is unstable, and I was wondering if you could comment on the instability of the regime internally and whether or not Kim Jong-un would be able to maintain power, and if not, what happens next?
You know, it's really interesting that Hazel Smith, a British academic, says that the regime is unstable, and it's probably more unstable than it's been since the 1950s. And she even says that the killing of Kim Jong-nam, the elder half-brother of the ruler of Kim Jong-un, was maybe ordered by somebody else in Pyongyang to teach the ruler a lesson. I don't know if this is true. I don't think the infighting is that fierce, but nonetheless, there is a lot of question about the stability of this regime. Chris.
Look, I appreciate all the questions about the instability of this regime, whether Kim Jong-un is crazy or whatever. But, you know, when you're a diplomat and you're looking across the table, that's what you got there.
Yeah.
And, yes, I mean, the guy's killed 375 senior people. He's apparently executed someone for falling asleep during one of his speeches, which would be a big problem for me in terms of... but, you know, I think we need to recognize that we're dealing with a serious threat,
yeah,
with an apparent command and control by Kim Jong-un and maybe a couple of other people who are nameless. But I think we spend too much energy on the question of whether he's stable or crazy, et cetera.
Real quick, I work very closely with Bill Perry on this, and he says the number one mistake we've made is we keep thinking this regime is going to go away. Evidence is to the contrary. These guys are here to stay. They're formidable. We cannot base a strategy on wishful thinking.
Can I respond to that?
Yeah, sure.
Right. Well, as a matter of fact, between two very opposed views about the stability of North Korea, let us just think about it in the sense that, well, North Korea in the whole world is the most closed society. We cannot think of any other regime as opaque as North Korea. So it is not surprising to me that there are all different kinds of views about the stability of North Korea. But at the same time, let us just try to get away from all these episodes. And then let us just try to think about putting North Korea into certain realm of analysis as a normal state, and then what, in fact, would be most on the minds of Kim Jong-un as a ruler of the normal state. I think security and economy, they would be the two things in the mind of Kim Jong-un. And I think that could be the case. Why? Because beginning from 2013, this is what Kim Jong-un has been saying. There are a large number of North Korean scholars in this room. So for you, you will be familiar with this terminology, which is Pyongjin. Pyongjin, that in fact is an official strategy of North Korea since 2013. What Pyongjin means is parallel pursuit of two different goals. And then what are the two different goals? First, development of nuclear weapons. Second, development of economy. And then for Kim Jong-un, in my mind, both, in fact, weapons of mass destruction as well as economic development, they are quintessential elements which will keep him in power. Yesterday, there was Senator Dan Coats. He said, well, what could be the motivation of Kim Jong-un? Would it be survival? Would it be leverage? We do not know. But at the same time, let's assume that maybe it will be survival. And then for his survival, Kim Jong-un knows that without weapons of mass destruction, without good economic growth, he will not be able to survive.
But you know,
the thing is, when it comes to economy, one thing we have to remember about North Korean economists this, which is that back in mid-1990s, North Korean distribution system, it collapsed. That is the reason why millions of people literally perished to death out of malnutrition. And then it was not out of choice, it was out of necessity. Then North Korea tried to reintroduce some market concepts into North Korean economy. It was rather messy in the first several years. And then, but at the same time, market elements, market incentives began to take place. And then today, what happened is, market elements, in fact, it is what is keeping North Korean economy afloat. What does it mean? It means our economic sanction, it works. So that is all the more reason why we should be doubling down on sanction against North Korea.
The one thing about stability, we'll just leave this issue, but the one thing is not so much about regime maintenance, whatever. We have a decision maybe in a year and a half when the North Koreans are able to nuke Seattle. We have to know whether we can deter North Korea. And the issue of deterrence is, of course, stability of the regime. There was a question right over here.
Could I just make one point before we start the question? I just wanted to say that in the six-party talks, I got going on that in 2005. And in addition to meeting my South Korean counterpart, Song Min-soon, the first person to come into Seoul from another delegation was none other than today Ambassador Kenichiro Sasai from Japan. And he came to my house, and we sat down, and he showed unbelievable staff work because he congratulated me on the Boston Red Sox winning the World Series.
Oh,
and then we
painful
went in,
moment in world history.
And
what? We should have a panel on that.
And then we went into the issue of the six-party talks, and it's just a real pleasure to have Kenichiro Sasai here in the audience because he has really, really did so much to move us forward.
General Hayden, first of all, I want to thank you for your service, but more important, I want to thank you for signing my copy of your book, Playing It to the Edge.
I should ask more questions. All right. Chris, I want to take you back to something you just alluded to. I used to, at a practical level, world life experience, I negotiated with the Korean People's Army at Panmunjom. All right. Difficult experience, but that was just double A ball. You've negotiated our last serious round of negotiations in the Bush administration with the North Koreans. Could you just talk a little bit about what that's like? What are the dynamics? How do you propose points? How do you move them off of theirs?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, the six-party talks needs to be understood as more of a platform. We would meet together in six delegations. We would meet bilaterally. We would meet trilaterally. There are a lot of different configurations. And most importantly, the Republic of Korea, Japan, and the U.S. would really try to coordinate our approaches to North Korea. We were, after all, the three baseball-playing countries in the six-party talks. The other three, by the way, bury their leaders under glass. But anyway, I mean, you could find all kinds of differences between Russia, China, and North Korea on one side and us on the other. But one of the things, Mike, one of the things I did was to sit down with the North Koreans and say, what do you want? What do you want? What are you looking for? And so they said, we want energy assistance because we see nuclear power leading to energy. And I said, we can do energy assistance and we can talk to you about different technologies and we can talk about a lot of things on energy assistance and help provide energy assistance. And that was something, by the way, the Republic of Korea really stepped up on electricity production. Secondly, they asked for economic assistance, and we're prepared to do that. All of us were prepared to do that. Thirdly, they wanted cross-recognition of states. They wanted us to recognize the DPRK as a sovereign state, and everyone would recognize each other, cross-recognition. Then they asked, we talked about a sort of regional peace and security mechanism. They wanted something like that as a sort of an added element in security. Then they wanted us to suspend the exercises. And I said, no. I said, we are not going to go that route for the reasons I explained to this group. And they kind of pushed on that. And I said, you know, my only regret about our exercises is we didn't have them in the spring of 1950, which is a bit of a sarcastic answer, but I just wanted to get them off of that. And then we went through a couple of other issues that they had asked about, in particular dealing with Japan, et cetera. So I got a clear understanding of what they wanted, and then we kind of caucused and figured out how we could help work with the Chinese and configure that joint statement of September 19th, 2005 to reflect North Korea desiderata, with our desiderata being basically one thing, which is denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula. So that was the origin of getting from the North Koreans what they wanted, explaining we could do certain things, and explaining we could not do something else. So now we've come back to this issue of exercises, and I think it's just the wrong road to go on.
Over here, there's a question.
Thanks. I'm Chris Eisham with CBS News. Question for the panel. We've sort of danced around the issue of sanctions, a couple of comments here. Could you talk a little bit about the specific kinds of sanctions that you think can be effective against North Korea? Ambassador Hill, you had experience with the sanctions on Banco Delta Asia, which were quite effective in terms of getting their attention, and the funds were then released, I believe, in 07. Are there other kinds of sanctions along those lines that could be deployed that might be effective now?
I don't want to. After you.
Let me just. The problem with the Banco Delta Asia sanctions were extremely effective. The problem was they came the day after we had gotten a negotiated agreement.
Actually, it was the day of.
The day of. So you have to understand this. There were, I don't know if Ambassador Hill can say this, there were rival factions in the Bush administration. Some wanted negotiations, and others followed the Dick Cheney rule. We don't negotiate with evil, we defeat it. And those people thought that there was some sort of regime change option, and then you could achieve that by military threats, maybe military action, or maybe sanctions. And the Banco Delta Asia, small, $25 million sanction, but it hit the bank accounts of the leadership, and it really ticked them off, and it got their attention. The problem is, it came after we had a negotiated agreement, and the North Koreans, you tell me if I'm wrong, thought, oh, well, we can't trust these people. We spend all this time, we come up with this agreement, we sign the paper, and now they're freezing our bank accounts, my bank account? Tell me if I'm wrong about that.
Timing is important, and just a little awkward, you know, toasting with that Chinese orange juice at the same time we were just slapping on. It was actually $23 million. We did get their attention. It took us about a year and a half to complete that, and ultimately it had the money. No one would take the money back. They couldn't unfreeze the thing. So we
much
ended up
more difficult unraveling it than putting it on.
We had, because there was no method for unraveling it, so we had to essentially have the Fed and the Russian Central Bank launder the money to put it back into the Russia Far East Bank. I understood the idea, but it was totally uncoordinated because of these sort of tribal factions going on in North Korea. I'm sorry, in Washington.
In Washington.
Sometimes I confuse the two. But let me just mention, though, with respect to sanctions, I think it's absolutely vital, if sanctions are to play any role, that China be fully supportive of sanctions. And quite frankly, while they've done the right thing in the United Nations, the follow-up has not been perfect. So I think China needs to do more in the way of sanctions, and they are doing more, but not enough. Secondly, there's something called secondary sanctions, where you go after Chinese or you go after third country entities that might be sort of facilitating North Korean financial behavior. And a lot of those third country entities are none other than Chinese banks, et cetera. And so these so-called secondary sanctions, I think we're at a point where it's a bad idea whose time has come, because we need to really close off North Korea on this. We need to really be absolutely effective. And if some bank in Damdong, which is down on the Yalu River across from North Korea, it looks, you know, compared to what's on the other side of the river, it looks like Las Vegas, but it's a little more modest, I guess. But the Damdong Bank needs to be shut down if that's what they're doing. But this bleeds into another question about how to deal with China. I think Henry Kissinger once observed that all State Department policy memos have three options, never four, never two. But the three options usually have one option bracketed by two rather impractical options. And the impractical options on China are the idea that we're going to make them our close ally in this process ain't going to happen. I mean, there is no consensus in China to jam North Korea. So we're not going to succeed in making them our close ally, but nor should we succeed in making them opposed to this whole process. We should not be taking measures that put them on the wrong side of this issue. So ultimately, the one in the middle, the Henry Kissinger solution, would have to be muddle along, try to keep them with us, try to get them to do things, but don't put them in a position of reacting against us, and don't expect them to come on board totally with us. So we've got to muddle through with them. It's not a beautiful thing. There'll be no victory parades down Pennsylvania Avenue about China's cooperation with us, but we need more or less to get something moving forward, to get them to do better on the sanctions, and to understand that nothing's ever going to be perfect.
Well, could I add one more thing?
Sure.
What is the matter of getting back to this question coming from our colleague coming from CBS, am I right? Right. Well, as a matter of fact, I think there are two related elements we should be looking at. First, what are the contents of the sanction? What are the contents of the sanction? Second thing we should be looking at would be the implementation, how they are being implemented. And then when it comes to China's role to be played, both in terms of what constitutes the contents of sanction as well as how we implement it, China's role is extremely important. In the context, let us just think about it, which is that, well, of course, I've been here since 1 o'clock yesterday, and then we have talked a lot about what China could be doing, what China is not doing, et cetera, et cetera. But at the same time, again, we just talked about BDA, so that was in September.
Banco Delta Asia.
Banco Delta Asia. So that was back in September 2005. And then last year, there was one Security Council resolution which was passed. That was Security Council Resolution 2270. And between 2005 and 2016, there are 11 years. And then the thing is, if you look at what, in fact, were the contents of sanction in 2005 and then 2016, in my view, there has been rather important and significant progress which has been made in the meantime. Why do I say that? It's because back in September 2005, Chris said it was $23 million. And then the way North Korea responded, how vehemently responded, but at the same time, it was not only North Korea. It was China as well, who in fact boycotted all the process for several months to come after that. So that was in September 2005. February 2016, what did China do? China agreed to this idea of closing down all North Korean bank accounts in China within coming 90 days. So if we look at the contents of sanction back in 2005 and then February 2016, there has been a big progress. But at the same time, another question is how China is implementing them. So for the time being at the United Nations, they're working on another resolution, but at the same time, what I think is truly important is how seriously China complies and then implements those international agreements. And then that's where this idea of secondary sanction comes in.
I'm dying to rebut everything you heard from the last two people, but my wife won't let me, and she's standing at the back, and she'll be really upset. So we'll go to this guy over here.
Alan Ace, a former U.S. Govy. Thanks to Joe for pointing out that our ballistic missile defense efforts cannot stop the North Korean tactical missile force simply because of numbers. What we're going to have to focus on is trying to prevent the North Korean nuclear genie from getting outside of the North Korean, the Korean Peninsula. That means we're going to have to scale whatever ballistic missile defense efforts we have against the nuclear force that we see coming forward. So the question is, can we project what their building rate is going to be and how large it's likely to get based on the nuclear material that they had and are producing? And that's to Joe.
Joe, yeah, that's
real. In the mid-20s, if they keep up the current pace, they'll probably have over 100 nuclear weapons. They will, if they haven't already, they will certainly have perfected the technique to so-called miniaturize them, to put them on missiles.
Plutonium, you're talking?
Plutonium.
100?
Yeah. And then, of course, they're ramping up their enriched uranium production, so they're opening up another stream as well. But the plutonium alone could probably do it. And their missile this was a very serious missile they tested on July 4th. It came faster than many people thought. It is extremely capable. It's not at all clear that that was its maximum range. It's possible that this missile could hit Seattle. We're expecting another test momentarily, days now. They've been popping them off about once every 2 weeks. There are two more ICBMs they showed in their parade earlier this year that they haven't tested yet. They'll probably test. Look, this is an odious, disgusting, repressive regime, perhaps the worst in the world. And it is a structurally different problem now that they have this kind of nuclear arsenal. For whatever their reasons, whether it's offensive to split the alliance and unify the peninsula by force, or it's defensive because they think we're coming after them. As bad as the negotiating option is, as difficult it is, as many grievances as we have with what's happened in the past, if we don't talk to these guys, I don't see any other solution to this. We're going to have to learn to live with a very large nuclear arsenal in North Korea, and that is a very uncomfortable situation for the United States.
Pam Brown.
Hi, how are you? Thank you, panel. Pamela Brown, Fox News. A quick question going back to the nuclear threat. What do we know about the current support of scientists going in and out of North Korea, perhaps with the help of Iran, as we've known before, that someone, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was extremely key to building some of their program? Any other things you can share about the scientists? Thank you.
Joe, do you want to talk?
Well, you guys probably have know more about this. They could not have gotten where they are today without substantial Chinese help, and we know that there are former Russian, Soviet rocket scientists that have helped them with the design of their engines. Many of their engines are mirrors of Soviet designs. Other than that, there does not appear to be a lot. Well, the Pakistan cooperation goes, maybe it's going the other way, but remember, North Korea is an exporter of technology. So they sold the Nodong, their extended-range Scud. They sold that to Iran and Pakistan and perhaps another country. And so basically the Shahab missile in Iran is a Nodong with Iranian colors. Same with the Pakistan original missile. But Pakistan and Iran have now gone, they have their own very capable engineers and have now gone up. So one of the things we really want to stop in North Korea is not just no more weapons, no more missile tests, it's no more export of this kind of technology.
And Pam, you know, there have been 5 North Korean detonations. Iranians have been on site for all of them. 3 of those first 3 detonations, that's open source. The last 2 have sort of been leaked out in the last several months. They've got there through China because they have been observed going through the Beijing Capital Airport. We're running out of time. I want to run down the panel. If you had, and I'm going to ask everyone the same question. If you had just 1 minute to talk to President Trump about how to disarm North Korea, how would you do it? And I know 1 minute's not a lot, but it's more than 140 characters. So, Joe, I'm going to start with you. As they say at the NFL draft, you're on the clock.
Disarming is a long-range objective that is not possible in the short term, so you've got to play the long game with them. You've got to engage in dialogue. You've got to get them to slow down or freeze their program. Engage in discussions and exchange of security values that might lead you to put you in a position where you might be able to talk about the denuclearization of the Korean Peninsula sometime hence.
you're fired.
Okay. Well,
Chris.
First, I'd tell him that the Russians interfered in our election. I just couldn't miss the opportunity. I would tell him we do have to work with China. It's tough. It's never going to be 100% satisfactory, but we do have to work with China and keep them on our side of the fence rather than the other. Secondly, we need to hold these allies close, South Korea and Japan. With respect to the THAAD system, it's important to have that kind of deployment because that shows the South Korean people, even though some of them have misgivings about it, but they need to know that we're putting our best stuff forward. Thirdly, I think we need to work in the UN, make sure those sanctions are as airtight as possible. Fourthly, I think it's very important to have active programs in the space, the narrow space between peace and war, whether it can be sabotage through cyber attacks, whatever. We need to have some kind of program aimed at direct efforts to slow down the development of their nuclear capabilities. And finally, I am a strong believer in keeping the door open to negotiation. If the U.S., as we did early on in the Bush administration, suggests we're not interested in negotiation, if I'm a South Korean citizen, I wonder what in the world is going on if they're afraid to negotiate with the North Koreans. And that was the main reason President Bush understood the need to get the six-party talks going, because we had something like 45% of the South Korean people believing that the U.S. was the cause of North Korea's nuclear ambitions. So absolutely, we've got to keep the door open to negotiation.
Ambassador Ahn, let me just change the question a little bit. Instead of speaking to President Trump, you're speaking to President Moon.
Well, as a matter of fact, first thing we have to get over, say efforts to deal with North Korean nuclear issue, that I think is the sense of frustration and sense of cynicism. And I think if there is only one piece of recommendation I'd be making to my president, it would be, well, have confidence in what we are doing. And then sanction, for the time being, we are working on sanction. Why? Military option, it is on the table, but for various reasons, it cannot be implemented too easily. Engagement, it wouldn't work for the same reason, for all the reasons I already shared with you. So the only viable option we have, that in fact is sanction, with an expectation that sanction would lead to the engagement of North Korea for a meaningful dialogue. What do I mean by meaningful dialogue? There is dialogue for the purpose of denuclearization. But at the same time, in order to do it, we must have confidence in what we are doing. And I think there are many good reasons why we should have confidence in what we are doing. Number one, China, it is not fully cooperating, but at the same time, I already told you, just let's look at the record of the past 11 years. It, in fact, has been moving in the right direction, even if the pace has not been sufficiently fast pace, it has been moving in the right direction. Second, let us just look at what North Korea is going through. Well, in fact, market element, profit incentive has been introduced to such a large extent into North Korean economy. In fact, economic sanction and all those sanctions, they work. So it will be taking time. But at the same time, we must have confidence in what we are doing.
I have a solution. I can put it in 140 characters. It goes like this. President Trump, you should tell the Chinese they can support the North Koreans or they can do business with the United States, but not both. Well, there you have it. We've solved North Korea. And that's the reason why we all come to the Aspen Security Forum. I want you to give a big hand to people in the Twitterverse who ask questions, to yourself for being so engaged, for these three rogues, and of course, most of all, to Clark and his team for bringing us all together.